I didn't say was that if I had to cut you off, it would hurt more than cutting off my finger. He stared at me for a long time, and then he said, "Oh, Sarah." We went upstairs, and it wasn't until we'd started that I realized we were having sex on the bed I used to share with Andrew. I was concentrating on Lawrence, burying my face in the soft hair on his chest, peeling the clothes off him. And then something happened. My bra strap snagged, Lawrence's belt buckle jammed for a second. I don't recall, but it stopped the flow anyway. And I realized that Lawrence was lying on Andrew's side of the bed, that his skin was pressing down where Andrew's had pressed, that the concave of Lawrence's back, smooth and hot with sweat, was arching proud of the depression that Andrew had made in the mattress. I hesitated. I froze up. Lawrence sensed it, I suppose, and he kept the momentum going. He rolled over onto me. I just felt so grateful to him, I think, for getting us through that moment without thinking. I let myself dissolve into the slickness of his skin, the delicacy of his movement, the lightness of him. Lawrence was tall, but he was slight. There was none of the bruising compression of my pelvis, the crushing of the breath from my lungs, the overpowering gravity of sex with Andrew that left me groaning as much in resignation as in pleasure. That was what I loved about sex with Lawrence, the glorious, giddying lightness of it. But there was something wrong tonight. Maybe it was the presence of Andrew, so strong in the room. His books and papers were everywhere still, jamming the bookshelves, scattered in the corners of the floor. And when I thought of Andrew, I thought of little B. Lawrence was making love to me, and part of me was thinking, ugh, while another part was thinking, in the morning I must phone the Border and Immigration Agency and start to track down her papers, and then I'll need to find her a solicitor and start an appeal procedure and I found I couldn't give myself up to Lawrence, not in that unhesitating, abandoned way I once had. Suddenly Lawrence seemed too light. His fingers barely brushed my skin, as if they were not engaging with my body, but merely tracing lines in some fine and invisible dust that Africa had cloaked me in. And when his weight came onto me, it was like being made love to by a summer cloud or a winter butterfly, by some creature in any case that lacked the authority to bend gravity around itself and become the moment's center. "What's wrong, Sarah?" I realized I was lying absolutely rigid. "Oh, God, I'm sorry." Lawrence stopped and rolled onto his back. I took hold of his penis, but already I could feel the softness returning to it. "Please," he said, "don't." I let go and took hold of his hand instead, but he pulled it free.
"I don't understand you, Sarah. I really don't."
"I'm sorry, Lawrence. It's Andrew. It's just too soon."
"He never stopped us while he was alive."
I thought about that. In the darkness outside, a low jet was climbing out of Heathrow, and a pair of owls were calling to each other desperately above the roar, their shrieks shrilling against the whining of the turbines. "You're right. It isn't Andrew."
"What is it, then?"
"I don't know. I love you, Lawrence, I really do. It's just that I've got so much to do."
"For little B?"
"Yes. I can't relax. I can't stop running it over and over in my head." Lawrence sighed.
"So what about us?" he said. "Do you think you're going to find time for us again, one of these days?"
"Oh, of course I will. You and me, we've got plenty of time, haven't we? We'll still be here in 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years. We've got time to work this out. We've got time to work out how to be together, now that Andrew's gone. But little B doesn't have that time. You said it yourself. If I can't fix things for her, they'll find her and they'll deport her. and she'll be gone, and that will be that. And what sort of a future would we have then? I wouldn't be able to look at you without thinking I should have done more to save her. Is that the future you want us to have?
Oh, God. Why can't you be like other people and just not give a shit?
Leggy blonde, likes music and movies, seeks solvent man for friendship and maybe more?
All right. I'm glad you're not one of them. But I don't want to lose you to a refugee girl who's really got no hope of staying here anyway.
Oh, Lawrence, you're not going to lose me. But you might have to share me with her for a while.
Lawrence laughed.
What? I said.
Well, it's just typical, isn't it? These immigrants, they come over here, they take our women.
Lawrence was smiling, but there was a guardedness in his eyes, an opaqueness that made me wonder how funny he found his own joke. It was strange to feel uncertain like this with him. Truly, he had never seemed at all complicated before. Then again, I realized I had never invested anything complicated in him until now. Perhaps it was me. I made myself relax, and I smiled back. I kissed him on the forehead. Thank you. Thank you for not making this harder than it is. Lawrence stared at me, and his face was thin and sad in the orange glow of the street lamps filtering in through the yellow silk blinds. The flutter in my stomach surprised me, and I realized that the hairs on my arms were up.
Sarah, he said, I honestly don't think you know how hard this is.
Chapter 7. Very early the next morning, Sarah looked into my room.
I'm glad you're awake, she said. We've run out of milk for Charlie's breakfast, so I'm popping down to the shop before he wakes up. 2 minutes. Do you want to come?
It was raining, so we went in Sarah's car. The windscreen wipers squeaked across the glass. Sarah chewed her lip between her teeth.
Look, she said. Lawrence staying overnight. I realize it must look a bit sudden, so I wanted to have this chat with you. I just wanted you to understand.
I laughed. Sarah was surprised and she looked across at me.
It is not hard to understand, I said. We are all trying to be happy in this world. I am happy because I do not think the men will come to kill me today. You are happy because you can make your own choices. And Lawrence is your choice, right?
Sarah laughed and shook her head while she steered through the rain.
Well, she said, that was a lot easier than I thought it would be. I smiled. It was good to see her laughing like this. I said to her, I do not think you are wrong for living the life you were born in. A dog must be a dog, and a wolf must be a wolf. That is the proverb in my country.
That's beautiful, said Sarah.
Actually, that is not the proverb in my country.
No?
No. Why would we have a proverb with wolves in it? We have 200 proverbs about monkeys, 300 about cassava. We talk about what we know. But I have noticed in your country, I can say anything so long as I say, that is the proverb in my country. Then people will nod their heads and look very serious.
Sarah laughed again.
That is a good trick, she said. Isn't that what you say, Bee?
I smiled. Happiness for Sarah was a long future where she could live the life of her choice. A dog must be a dog, and a wolf must be a wolf, and a bee must be a bee. And when they run out of milk, all God's creatures must go to the shop.
Sarah looked across at me from the driving seat.
Bless you for understanding, she said.
I understood, but Sarah's happiness and Sarah's future are more things I would have to explain to the girls from back home. A country's future is found in its natural resources. It is my country's biggest export. It leaves so quickly through our seaports, the girls from my village could never even see it, and they could not know what it looked like. Actually, the future looks like gasoline. I discovered this when I was reading the newspapers in the detention center, and finally I made sense of what had happened to me back home. What had happened was, the oil companies had discovered a huge reserve of the future underneath my village. To be precise, what they discovered was crude oil, which is the future before it has been refined. It is like a dream of the future, really, and like any dream, it ends with a rude awakening. The men came while we were preparing the evening meal. While the blue wood smoke mixed with the thick steam of the cassava pots in the golden evening sun. It happened so quickly that the women had to grab us children and run with us into the jungle. We hid there while we listened to the screams of the men who stayed behind to fight. On the dashboard of Sarah's car, a light went on. "Oh," she said, "we need petrol." Water sprayed up off the rainy road. Sarah turned the car into a service station. We got out. There were no other cars. I listened to the rain beating down on the canopy above the gasoline pumps. Sarah looked at me as she held the gasoline hose. "Do you still want to stay?" she said. I nodded. The gasoline flowing through the pump made a high-pitched sound, as if the screaming of my family was still dissolved in it. The nozzle of the gasoline hose went right inside the fuel tank of Sarah's car, so that the transfer of the fluid was hidden. I still do not know what gasoline truly looks like. If it looks the way it smells on a rainy morning, then I suppose it must flash like the most brilliant happiness, so intense that you would go blind or crazy if you even looked at it. Maybe that is why they do not let us see gasoline. When the filling was finished, Sarah went inside the service station shop to pay. She came out with a large plastic bottle of milk, and we drove back to the house. It was still only 6:30 in the morning. Sarah closed the front door behind us, and she yawned. "Charlie won't be up for an hour at least," she said. "I think I might go back to bed." I nodded. Sarah smiled. On her face was a look of relief. I realized, this is what you can do for her, little bee. You can understand. I went into the kitchen and I filled the kettle to make myself a drink of tea. Understanding. That would have been a good name for my village, even before the men came to burn our huts and drill for oil. It would have been a good name for the clearing around the limber tree, where we children swung on that bald old car tire, and bounced on the seats of my father's broken Peugeot and my uncle's broken Mercedes, with the springs poking out from them, and where we chanted church songs from a hymn book with the covers missing and the pages held together with tape. We knew what we had. We had nothing. Your world and our world have come to this understanding. Even the missionaries had boarded up their mission. They left us with the holy books that were not worth the expense of shipping back to your country. In our village, our only Bible had all of its pages missing after the 46th verse of the 27th chapter of Matthew, so that the end of our religion, as far as any of us knew, was, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" We understood that this was the end of the story. That is how we lived, happily and without hope. I was very young then, and I did not miss having a future, because I did not know I was entitled to one. From the rest of the world, all we knew was from that one old movie about a man who was in a great hurry, sometimes in jet planes and sometimes on motorbikes and sometimes upside down. From the wind-up radios, we had a little news, but mostly music. We also had a TV, but in understanding, there was no reception, and you had to make the programs yourself. Our TV was just a wooden frame around where the screen used to be, and the frame sat in the red dust underneath the limba tree. And my sister, Enkiruka, used to put her head inside the frame to do the pictures. This is a good trick. I know now that we should have called this reality television. My sister used to adjust the bow on her dress and put a flower in her hair just so and smile through the screen and say, "Hello, this is the news from the British BBC. Today ice cream will snow down from the sky and no one will have to walk to the river for water because the engineers will come from the city and put a standpipe in the middle of the village." And the rest of us children, we would all sit in a half circle around the television set and we would watch Enkiruka announcing the news. We loved these dreams of hers. In the pleasant afternoon shade, we would gasp with delight and all of us would say, "Where?" One of the good things about understanding was that you could talk back to television. The rest of us children, we used to shout at Enkiruka, "This ice cream snow, exactly what time will it occur?" "In the early evening, of course, when the day is cooler." "How do you know this, Madam Television Announcer?" "Because the day must be cool enough or the ice cream would melt, of course. Do you children know nothing?" And we children would sit back and nod at one another. Evidently the day would need to be cool enough first. We were very satisfied with the television news. You can play the same trick with television in your country, but it is harder because the television sets do not listen. Early in the morning, after Sarah had gone back to bed, when we came home from the service station, it was Charlie who wanted to turn the television on. He appeared in the kitchen in his bat costume and bare feet. I said, "Good morning, little bat. Do you want breakfast?" He said, "No, I doesn't want breakfast. I does want television." So I said, "Does your mummy say it is okay for you to watch television before breakfast?" Charlie looked at me, and his eyes were very patient, like a teacher who has told you the answer 3 times already, but you have forgotten it. "Mummy is asleep, actually," he said. So we went into the next room and we switched on the television. We looked at the pictures without the sound. It was the BBC Morning News, and they were showing pictures of the Prime Minister making a speech. Charlie put his head on one side to watch. The ears of his Batman hood flopped over. He said, "That is the Joker, isn't it?" "No, Charlie. That is the Prime Minister."
"Is he a goody or a baddie?"
I thought to myself. Half the people think he is a goody, and the other half think he is a baddie. Charlie giggled.
"That's silly," he said.
"That is democracy," I said. "If you did not have it, you would want it." We sat and watched the Prime Minister's lips moving.
"What's he saying?" said Charlie.
"He is saying that he will make ice cream snow." Charlie spun round to look at me.
"When?"
he said. "About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if the weather is cool enough." He is also saying that young people who are running away from trouble in other countries will be allowed to stay in this country, so long as they work hard and do not make any fuss. Charlie nodded.
"I think the Prime Minister is a goody."
"Because he will be kind to refugees?"
Charlie shook his head.
"Because of the ice cream snow," he said.
There was a laugh from the door. I turned around and Lawrence was there. He was wearing a bathrobe, and he stood there in his bare feet. I do not know how long he had been listening to us.
"Well," he said, "we know how to buy that boy's vote."
I looked at the floor. I was embarrassed that Lawrence had been standing there.
"Oh, don't be shy," he said. "You're great with Charlie. Come and have some breakfast."
"Okay," I said. "Batman, do you want some breakfast?" Charlie stared at Lawrence, and then he shook his head. So I switched through the TV channels until we found the one that Charlie liked, and then I went into the kitchen.
"Sarah's sleeping," said Lawrence. "I suppose she needs the rest."
"Tea or coffee?"
"Tea, thank you."
Lawrence boiled the kettle, and he made tea for both of us. He put my tea down on the table in front of me, carefully, and he turned the handle of the mug toward my hand. He sat down on the other side of the table and smiled. The sun was lighting up the kitchen. It was thick yellow, a warm light, but not a show-off light. It did not want the glory for the illumination of the room. It made each object look as if it was glowing with a light from deep inside itself. Lawrence, the table with its clean blue cotton tablecloth, his orange tea mug, and my yellow one, all of it glowing from within. The light made me feel very cheerful. I thought to myself, "That is a good trick." But Lawrence was serious.
"Look," he said, "I think you and I need to make a plan for your welfare. I'm going to be very clear about this. I think you should go to the local police and report yourself. I don't think it's right for you to expose Sarah to the stress of harboring you."
I smiled. I thought about Sarah harboring me as if I was a boat.
Lawrence said, "This isn't funny."
"But no one is looking for me. Why should I go to the police?"
"I don't think it's right you're being here. I don't think it's good for Sarah at the moment."
I blew on my tea. The steam from it rose up into the still air of the kitchen, and it glowed. "Do you think you are good for Sarah at the moment, Lawrence?"
"Yes. Yes, I do."
"She is a good person. She saved my life." Lawrence smiled.
"I know Sarah very well," he said. "She told me the whole story."
"So you must believe I am only staying here to help her."
"I'm not convinced you're the kind of help she needs."
"I am the kind of help that will look after her child like he was my own brother. I am the kind of help that will clean her house and wash her clothes and sing to her when she is sad. What kind of help are you, Lawrence? Maybe you are the kind of help that only arrives when it wants sexual intercourse."
Lawrence smiled again. "I'm not going to take offense at that," he said. "You're one of those women who has a funny idea about men."
"I am one of those women who has seen men do things that are not funny."
"Oh, please. This is Europe. We're a little more house-trained over here."
"Different from us, you think?"
"If you must put it that way."
I nodded. "A wolf must be a wolf, and a dog must be a dog."
"Is that what they say in your country?"
I smiled.
Lawrence frowned.
"I don't get you," he said. "If you understood how serious your situation is, I don't think you'd smile."
I shrugged.
"If I could not smile, I think my situation would be even more serious." We drank tea and he watched me and I watched him. He had green eyes, green as the eyes of the girl in the yellow sari
on the day they let us out of the detention center. He watched me without blinking.
What will you do? I said. What will you do if I do not go to the police?
Will I turn you in myself, you mean?
I nodded. Lawrence tapped his fingers on the sides of his tea mug.
I'll do what's best for Sarah, he said.
The fear raced right through me, right into my belly. I watched Lawrence's fingers tapping. His skin was white as a seabird's egg, and fragile like it too. He held his hands around his mug of tea. He had long, smooth fingers, and they were curled around the orange china mug as if it was a baby animal that might do something foolish if it was allowed to escape.
You are frightening me, Lawrence.
I'm reacting to the situation, that's all. That's what Andrew didn't do. He was like a stuck record. He stuck to his principles and he let this thing with you overwhelm him and Sarah. That's why he lost her.
I shook my head. Don't you have principles too?
Lawrence sat forward in his chair. My principle is that I love Sarah. You can't imagine what she means to me. Apart from her, my life is utterly mundane. I'll do anything to keep Sarah. Anything. Do you understand?
You are worried I will take Sarah away from you. That is why you do not want me here. It is nothing to do with what is good for her.
I'm worried Sarah's going to do something silly to try to help you. Change her focus. Change her life more than she needs to right at this moment.
And you are worried she will forget all about you in her new life?
Yes, all right. Yes. But you can't imagine what would happen to me if I lost Sarah. I'd fall apart. I'd hit the bottle. Bam! It'd be the end of me. That terrifies me, even if you think it sounds pathetic.
I took a sip of tea. I tasted it very carefully. I shook my head. It is not pathetic. In my world, death will come chasing. In your world, it will start whispering in your ear to destroy yourself. I know this because it started whispering to me when I was in the detention center. Death is death. All of us are scared of it.
Lawrence turned his tea mug around and around in his hands.
Is it really death that you're running from? I mean, honestly. A lot of people who come here, they're after a comfortable life.
If they deport me to Nigeria, I will be arrested. If they find out who I am and what I have seen, then the politicians will find a way to have me killed. Or, if I am lucky, they will put me in prison. A lot of people who have seen what the oil companies do, they go to prison for a long time. Bad things happen in a Nigerian prison. If people ever get out, they do not feel like talking.
Lawrence shook his head slowly. But whatever's going to happen to you is going to happen eventually, whether I do anything or not.
This isn't your country. They'll come for you.
I promise you they will. They come for all of you in the end.
You could hide me?
Yeah, right. Like they hid Anne Frank in the attic. Look how that worked out for her.
Who is Anne Frank?
Lawrence closed his eyes and folded his hands behind his neck and sighed. Another girl who wasn't my problem, he said.
I felt a rage exploding inside me, so fierce that it made my eyeballs hurt. I banged my hand down on the table, and his eyes snapped open wide. Sarah would hate you if you told the police about me.
Sarah wouldn't know. I've seen how the immigration people work. They would come for you in the night. You wouldn't have time to tell Sarah. You wouldn't get to say a word.
I stood up. I would find a way. I would find a way to tell her what you had done. And I would find a way to tell your wife, too. I would break both of your lives, Lawrence. your family life and your secret life.
Lawrence looked surprised. He stood up and walked around the kitchen. He ran his hands through his hair.
Yeah, he said. I really think you would.
I would. Please do not imagine I would forgive you, Lawrence. I would make sure I hurt you.
Lawrence looked out at the garden.
Oh, he said.
I waited.
After a long time, he said,
It's funny. I've been lying awake all night, thinking what to do about you. I thought about what would be best for Sarah, and what would be best for me. I honestly didn't even think about what you'd do. I suppose I should have. I just assumed you wouldn't be so switched on. When Sarah talked about you, I was imagining, I don't know, not someone like you anyway.
I have been in your country 2 years. I learned your language and I learned your rules. I am more like you than me now.
Lawrence laughed down his nose again.
I really don't think you're anything like me, he said.
He sat down at the kitchen table again and held his head in his hands.
I'm a shit, he said. I'm a loser, and you've got me over a barrel.
He looked up at me.
You won't really tell Linda, will you?
His eyes were exhausted. I sighed and sat down opposite him. We should be friends, Lawrence.
He laughed. I've just admitted to you that I'd sell you down the river if I could. You're the brave little refugee girl, and I'm the selfish bastard. I think our roles here are pretty clearly delineated, don't you?
I shook my head. I am selfish too, you know.
No, you're really not.
Now you think I'm a sweet little girl, don't you? In your mind you still don't think I really exist. It does not occur to you that I can be clever like a white person, that I can be selfish like a white person. I realized I was so angry I was shouting. Lawrence just laughed at me.
Selfish, you! Took the last biscuit out of the tin, did you? Left the top off Sarah's toothpaste.
I left Sarah's husband hanging in the air, I said.
Lawrence stared at me. What? I swallowed more tea, but it was too cold now, and I put the mug down on the table. The light in the kitchen was cooling too. I watched the glow fade from all the objects in the room, and I felt the cold flow into my bones. All the anger went out of me. Lawrence?
Yes?
Maybe it is better that I go somewhere else.
Stop. Wait. What did you just tell me?
Maybe you were right. Maybe it is better for Sarah, and better for Charlie, and better for you if I am not here. I could just run away. I am good at running, Lawrence.
Shut up, said Lawrence quietly. He gripped my wrist.
Stop it! That hurts!
Then tell me what you've done.
I do not want to tell you. I am frightened now.
Me too. Talk.
I held on to the edge of the table, and I breathed in and out against my fear. Sarah said it was strange that I came on the day of Andrew's funeral.
Yes.
It was not a coincidence.
Lawrence let go of my arm, and he stood up quickly, and he put his hands on the back of his neck. He went to the kitchen window and stared out for a long time. Then he turned back to me.
What happened? He whispered.
I don't think I should tell you. I shouldn't have said anything. I was angry.
Tell me.
I looked down at the backs of my hands. I realized that I did want to tell someone, and I knew I could never tell Sarah. I looked up at him. I telephoned Andrew on the morning they let me out of the immigration detention center. I told him I was coming.
Is that all?
Then I walked here from the immigration detention center. I came in 2 days. I hid in the garden.
I pointed through the window.
There, I said, behind that bush where the cat is. Then I waited. I did not know what I wanted to do. I think I wanted to say thank you to Sarah for saving me, but also I wanted to punish Andrew for letting my sister be killed. And I did not know how to do either of these things, so I waited. I waited for 2 days and 2 nights, and I did not have anything to eat, so I came out when it was dark, and I ate the seeds from the bird feeder and drank the water from the tap on the outside of the house. In the daytime, I watched through the windows of the house, and I listened when they came out into the garden. I saw how Andrew talked to Sarah and Charlie. He was terrible. He was angry all the time. He would not play with Charlie. When Sarah talked, he just shrugged his shoulders or he shouted at her. But when he was alone, he did not stop shrugging or shouting. He would stand all alone at the end of the garden and talk to himself. And sometimes he would shout at himself or hit himself on the head with the side of his fist like this. He cried a lot. Sometimes he would fall down to his knees in the garden and weep for an hour. This is when I realized he was full of evil spirits.
He was clinically depressed. It was very hard for Sarah.
I think it was very hard for him, too. I watched him for a long time. One time when he was weeping, I watched him too hard, and I forgot to hide myself, and he looked up and he saw me. I thought, oh no, now this is it, little bee. But Andrew did not come toward me. He stared at me and he said, oh Jesus, you are not real. You are not there. Just get out of my fucking head. And then he closed his eyes tight and he rubbed them, and while he was doing this, I hid myself back behind the bush. When he opened his eyes, he looked again where I had just been, but he did not see me. Then he went back to talking to himself.
He thought he was hallucinating you. Poor bastard.
Yes, but I did not feel sorry for him at first. It was only later. On the third day he came out into the garden again when Sarah was at work and Charlie was at the nursery. He was drunk, I think. His words were coming out slow and twisted.
That would have been his medication, said Lawrence.
His face had gone very white now, and he was still staring at me with his eyes very bright.
Go on, he said.
It was still early in the morning. Andrew started shouting. He said,
come out! Come out! What do you want?
I did not say anything.
Please,
he said.
I know you are a ghost. What do you want to make you go away?
I stepped out from behind the laurel bush, and he took one step back. I am not a ghost, I said. He started hitting himself on the side of the head.
He said, you are not real. You are in my head. You are not there.
He closed his eyes and he shook his head. While he had his eyes closed, I walked right up to him, close enough to touch. When he opened his eyes and saw how close I was, he screamed and he ran inside the house. I felt sorry for him then. I followed him into the house. Please listen, I said. I am not a ghost. I came because I do not know anyone else. Then he said,
touch me. Prove you are not a ghost.
So I moved closer, and I put my hand on his hand. When he felt my hand, he closed his eyes for a long time, and then he opened them again. I walked up the stairs, and he walked in front of me. He walked up the stairs backward. He was screaming.
Get out! Get out!
He ran into his workroom, his study, and he closed the door. So I stood outside the door and I shouted, "Do not be afraid of me. I am only a human being." There was a very long silence, so I went away. Lawrence's hands were shaking. There were ripples on the surface of the tea in his cup. A little while later I came back. Andrew was standing on a chair in the middle of the room. What he had done, he had tied an electrical cable around the wooden beam in the ceiling. He had tied the other end around his neck. He looked at me, and I looked at him. Then he whispered to me. He said, "It was a long time ago, okay? A long way away. Why won't you just stay over there?" So I said, "I am sorry. It is not safe over there." And he said, "I know you died over there. I know you're only in my head." He looked at me for a long time. His eyes were red and they were flickering around the room. I moved closer to him, but he started shouting. He said, "If you come closer, I will step off this chair." So I stopped. I said, "Why are you doing this?" He answered in a very quiet voice. He said, "Because I've seen the person I am." I said, "But you are a good person, Andrew. You care about the way the world is. I read your articles in the Times when I was learning English." Andrew shook his head. He said,
"Words are nothing. The person I am is the person you saw on that beach. He knows where the commas go, but he wouldn't cut off one finger to save you."
So I smiled at him, and I said, "It doesn't matter. Look, I am here. I am alive." And he thought about this for a long time. He said,
"What happened to the girl who was with you?"
So I said, "She is fine. She could not come here with me, that is all."
He looked into my eyes then. He looked and looked until I could not look him in the eyes anymore, and I had to look down at the floor. And then he said,
"Liar."
Then he closed his eyes and he stepped off the chair.
The noises he made from his throat, it was like the noises my sister made while they killed her.
Lawrence held on to the kitchen worktop.
"Shit," he said.
I tried to help him, but he was too heavy. I could not lift up his body. I tried until I was exhausted, and I was crying, but I could not take the weight off the cord. I pushed the chair under his legs, but he kicked it away. After a long time, he stopped struggling, but he was still alive. I could see his eyes watching me. He was spinning round on the cord. He was turning very slowly, and each time his body turned to face me, his eyes followed me until he spun around too far. His eyes were bulging out and his face was purple, but he was watching me. I thought, I have to help him. I thought, I must call for the neighbors or I must call an ambulance. I started running down the stairs to get help. But then I thought, if I call for help, the authorities will know that I am here. And if the authorities know that I am here, they will deport me, or maybe even worse. Because here is something, Lawrence. After they let us out of the immigration detention center, one of the other girls I was with, she hanged herself too. I ran away from that place, but the police must know I was there. Two hangings, you see. The police would be suspicious. They would think I had something to do with it. I could not let them find me like that.
So I ran out of Andrew's study, and I held my head in my hands, and I tried to think what to do, whether I should give up my life to save Andrew's life. At first I thought, of course I must save him, whatever it costs me, because he is a human being. And then I thought, of course I must save myself, because I am a human being too. And then after I had been standing there for 5 minutes thinking these things, I realized it was too late, and I had saved myself. And then I went to the refrigerator and ate, because I was very hungry. After that, I went back down the far end of the garden to hide, and I did not come out until the funeral. My hands were shaking. Lawrence took a deep breath. His hands were shaking too.
"Oh, God, this is serious," he said. "This is very, very serious."
"Do you see now? Do you see why I want to help Sarah so much? Do you see why I want to help Charlie? I made the wrong choice, Lawrence. I let Andrew die. Now I must do everything I can to make things right."
Lawrence was walking up and down the kitchen. He was holding the dressing gown closed around him, and his fingers were twisting on the cloth. He stopped and looked at me.
"Does Sarah know any of this?"
I shook my head.
"I am scared to tell her. I think if I tell her, then she will make me go away from here, and then I will not be able to help her, and then there will be no way for me to make up for the bad thing I did. And if I cannot make up for it, then I do not know what I will do. I cannot run away again. There is nowhere to go. I have discovered the person I am, and I do not like her. I am the same as Andrew. I am the same as you. I tried to save myself. Tell me, please, where is the refuge from that?"
Lawrence stared at me.
"What you did is a crime," he said. "Now I don't have a choice. I have to go to the police."
I started to cry. "Please, don't go to the police. They will take me away. I just want to help Sarah. Don't you want to help Sarah?"
"I love Sarah, so don't fucking well talk to me about helping her. Do you really think it was helpful to come here?"
I was sobbing now. "Please," I said, "please." There were tears running down my face. Lawrence slammed his hand down on the table.
"Shit," he said.
"I'm sorry, Lawrence. I'm sorry."
Lawrence slapped the palm of his hand against his forehead.
"Oh, you fucking bitch," he said. "I can't go to the police, can I? I can't let Sarah find out. Her head is fucked up enough about all this. If she knows you were there when Andrew died, she'll lose it. And it would be the end of me and her, of course it would. I couldn't go to the police without Linda finding out. This would be all over the newspapers. But I don't even want to think what this is going to be like, being with Sarah when I know this and she doesn't. And the police! Fuck! If I don't tell the police, I'm as culpable as you are. What if it gets out, and they realize I knew all along? I'm the one who's been sleeping with the dead man's wife, for fuck's sake! I've got motive. I could go to prison. If I don't pick up the phone and call the police right now, then I could go to prison for you, little bee. Do you understand that? I could go to prison for you when I don't even know your real name."
I folded my two hands over Lawrence's hand, and I looked up into his face. I could not see him at all, just a pale shape against the light, blurry with tears. "Please, I have to stay here. I have to make up for what I did. Please, Lawrence, I will tell nobody about you and Sarah, and you must tell nobody about me. I am asking you to save me. I am asking you to save my life." Lawrence tried to pull his hand away, but I held on to it. I put my forehead against his arm.
"Please," I said, We can be friends. We can save each other.
Oh, God, he said quietly. I wish you hadn't told me any of this.
You made me tell you, Lawrence. I am sorry. I know what I am asking you. I know it will hurt you to keep the truth from Sarah. It is like asking you to cut off a finger for me.
Lawrence pulled his hand out from under my hands. Then he took his hand away completely. I sat at the table with my eyes closed, and I felt the skin of my forehead itching where it had rested on his arm. It was quiet in the kitchen, and I waited. I do not know how long I waited for. I waited till my tears were dry, and the terror inside me was all gone, and the only thing left was a quiet, dull misery that made my head and my eyeballs ache. There was no thought in my head then. I was just waiting. And then I felt Lawrence's hands on my cheeks. He cupped my face in his hands. I did not know if I was supposed to push his hands away or to place my hands upon his. We stayed like that for a little while, and Lawrence's hands trembled on my cheeks. He turned my face up toward his, so I had to look into his eyes.
I wish I could just make you disappear, he said.
But I'm nobody. I'm just a civil servant. I won't tell the police about you. Not if you keep quiet. But if you tell anyone ever about Sarah and me, or if you tell anyone ever about what happened with Andrew, I will have you on a plane to Nigeria, I swear. It will be the last thing I do before my life falls apart.
I breathed out one long, deep breath. I understand, I whispered. Sarah's voice came from upstairs.
Who said you could watch TV, Batman?
Lawrence took his hands away from my face and he went to make more tea. Sarah came into the kitchen. She was yawning, and her eyes were screwed up against the sunlight. Charlie came with her, holding her hand.
I might as well tell you two grown-ups the rules, said Sarah, since you're both new around here. Superheroes, especially Dark Knights, are not allowed to watch television before they've eaten their breakfast, are they, Batman?
Charlie grinned at her and shook his head.
Right, said Sarah. Bat flakes or bat toast?
Bat toast, said Charlie.
Sarah went to the toaster and put two slices of bread in to eat. Lawrence and I, we both just watched her. Sarah turned around.
Is everything all right in here? She said.
She looked at me. Have you been crying?
It is nothing, I said. I always cry in the morning.
Sarah frowned at Lawrence. I hope you've been looking after her.
Of course, said Lawrence. Little B and I have been getting to know one another.
Sarah nodded. Good, she said. Because we really have to make this work. You both know that, don't you? She looked at each of us, and then she yawned again, and she stretched her arms.
Fresh start, she said.
I looked at Lawrence, and Lawrence looked at me. Now, said Sarah, I'm going to take Charlie to nursery, and then we can start to track down Little B's papers. We'll find you a solicitor first. I know a good one that we sometimes use on the magazine. Sarah smiled, and she went over to Lawrence. And as for you, she said, I'm going to find a little time to thank you for coming all the way to Birmingham. She put her hand up to Lawrence's face, but then I think she remembered that Charlie was in the room, and so she just brushed her hand against his shoulder instead. I went into the next room to watch the television news with the sound turned off.
The news announcer looked so much like my sister. My heart was overflowing with things to say. But in your country, you cannot talk back to the news. Chapter 8. I remember the exact day when England became me, when its contours cleaved to the curves of my own body, when its inclinations became my own. As a girl, on a bike ride through the Surrey lanes, pedalling in my cotton dress through the hot fields, blushing with poppies, freewheeling down a sudden dip into a cool wooded sanctum, where a stream ran beneath the flint and brick bridge. Coming to a stop, the brakes squealing from the work of plucking one still moment out of time. Throwing my bicycle down into a pungent cushion of cow parsley and wild mint, and sliding down the plunging bank into the clear, cold water, my sandals kicking up a quick brown bloom of mud from the stream bed, the minnows darting away into the black pool of shade beneath the bridge. Pressing my face into the water, with time utterly suspended, drinking in the cool shock. And then looking up and seeing a fox. He was sunning himself on the far bank, watching me through a feathery screen of barley. I looked back at him and his amber eyes held mine. The moment, the country, I realized it was me. I found a soft patch of wild grass and cornflower by the side of the barley field, and I lay down with my face close to the damp earthen smell of the grass roots, listening to the buzzing of the summer flies. I cried, but I didn't know why. The morning after Lawrence stayed overnight, I dropped off Charlie at nursery, and I went home to see what I could do to help little Bee. I found her upstairs, watching television with the sound turned off. She looked so sad. "What's wrong?" I said. Little Bee shrugged. "Is everything okay with Lawrence?" She looked away. "What is it, then?" "Nothing." "Maybe you're homesick. I know I would be. Do you miss your country?" She turned to look at me, and her eyes were very solemn. "Sarah," she said, "I do not think I have left my country. I think it has travelled with me." She turned back to the television. "That's all right," I thought. "There'll be plenty of time to get through to her." I tidied the kitchen while Lawrence was showering. I made myself a coffee and realized for the first time since Andrew died that I had taken only one cup down from the cupboard instead of my instinctual two. I stirred in the milk. The spoon clinked against the china, and I realized I was losing the habit of being Andrew's wife. How strange, I thought. I smiled and realized I felt strong enough to put in an appearance at the magazine. At my usual time, the commuter train was crowded with pinstripes and laptop bags, but now it was 10:30 in the morning, and the train ran nearly empty. The boy opposite me stared at the carriage's ceiling. He wore an England shirt and blue jeans, white with plaster dust. Tattooed on the inside of his forearm in a Gothic typeface were the words, "This is a time for heroes." I stared at the tattoo, at the fixity of its pride and its broken grammar. When I looked up, the boy was watching me back, his amber eyes calm and unblinking. I blushed and stared out the window at the flickering back gardens of the semis. The train braked as we neared Waterloo. There was a sensation of being between worlds. The brake shoes squealed against the train's metal wheels, and I felt 8 years old again. Here I was, converging with my magazine on unflinching rails. Soon I would arrive at a terminus and have to prove that I could step off this carriage and back into my grown-up job. When the train stopped, I turned to say something to the boy with amber eyes, but he had already stood from his seat and disappeared back into the cover of the barley field beneath the shade of the sheltering woods. I arrived on the editorial floor at 11:30. The place went quiet. All the girls stared at me. I smiled and clapped my hands. "Come on, back to work," I said.
When 100,000 ABC1 urban professional women between the ages of 18 and 35 lose focus, then so will we, but not until. At the far end of the open plan, Clarissa was sitting behind my desk.